Hello, friends. Dr. Ken Berry here. Thank you for joining me for the latest edition of Live at 5. Today, I have the distinct pleasure and honor of having a chat with Dr. Robert Lustig. You may have heard of this fellow. He's got a YouTube video called Sugar, the Bitter Truth, which currently has over 13 million views. I personally wish it had 130 million views because that's how many people in the world need it today. He's written multiple books. He's written 105 peer-reviewed papers and 65 review papers. So this is not a guy that's just running his mouth. This is a guy that's put in the time, that's done the work, that's been in the trenches for decades as a pediatric endocrinologist and neuroendocrinologist. And I think this is going to be a very enjoyable conversation. Dr. Lustig and I are both smartasses, so we tend to just tell it like it is. We don't really beat around the bush much. So if you're offended by honest, straight talk, this may not be the discussion for you. But let me see if I can get Dr. Lustig in here. There he is. Welcome, doctor.
Thanks so much for having me, Dr. Berry. And you are absolutely right. We are going to pull no punches here.
That's exactly right. I hope you weren't offended by my smart-ass comment. That's actually for where I'm from. That's a very high compliment.
I was going to say, I wear it with pride.
Absolutely. So do I. So all you guys watching this, we're going to be talking about metabolic health. We're going to be talking about Dr. Lustig's new book, Metabolical, which I love that title. And we're going to be talking about how big food basically takes you to the cleaners and leaves you broken sick. Oh, you got it? Yeah, bring that book in here. Let's see what it looks like. There we go. I love it. I love it. If you have a friend or a family member who's suffering from at least one marker of metabolic syndrome, and if you watch my YouTube videos, you know what those markers are. This is a video that they will probably benefit greatly from if you share it with them. There it is. Metabolical. I love that. Metabolism and diabolical. That's the contraction word. I love it. So Dr. Lustig, I gave a brief introduction of you. Give us a little bit of your background before we get started. Why you are really, you are vetted beyond anybody else to speak about metabolic disease because you studied at the very beginning of life, even in the womb. You've done quite a bit of research on how metabolic disease, metabolic syndrome, obesity, diabetes, fatty liver, how all these things start. Kind of give us a quick roadmap of how you got from the beginning of your medical career to where you're at today.
Well, I came at this from the back door. And you know, I'm very clear on that. I basically followed the science. I followed the data. I didn't come at this with an agenda. Now, I always was interested in endocrinology. I was always interested in nutrition. I majored in nutrition and food science in college. And I remember my teachers, my professors at MIT, basically telling me that, you know, different foods were metabolized in different ways. Sanford Miller, who ran the FDA for a decade, you know, was one of my professors. He was 300 pounds and he walked in the first day to physiologic and nutritional biochemistry. And first words out of his mouth is, why do we eat? And I figured if anybody knows, he does. But then I went to medical school and over the next 4 years, they beat my interest in nutrition anatomy. Because they basically said, well, you know, all that stuff you learn, you know, that's all fine for rats, and, you know, in the test tube and, you know, for science. But that's not how we take care of patients. This is how we take care of patients, you know, and right. I'm paying, you know, a tuition bill.
Prescription pad. That's how you take care of patients.
That's exactly right. And so I did what they told me. And, you know, I mean, I had a little bit of lip, but not too much. You know, I want to graduate. I didn't come at this, you know, expecting to sort of, you know, shake some, you know, long-standing dogma in the field. I had an idea many, many, many years ago about the notion between the connection between the brain and the fat cell. and I worked at Rockefeller University, where leptin was ultimately discovered, Dr. Jeff Friedman. And so I was actually, I knew about it and I was sort of in on it. Rudy Leibel was a good friend. He was one of the people who helped clone leptin, so I was aware that there was some feedback control in the OB versus DB mouse, but I didn't know what it was. But what I did know was that I had taken care of patients with these brain tumors who had, survived the brain tumor only to become massively obese. I had seen one in my residency. I had seen one in my fellowship. And I knew they were out there. And I ended up working at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital as a neuroendocrinologist to try to take care of them. And in 1994, leptin was cloned. And I went to St. Jude in 1995. And I was presented with a cadre of about 30 patients who had survived their brain tumor only to become massively obese. This form of obesity called hypothalamic obesity due to hypothalamic damage. And so I postulated at the time, well, clearly these patients had normal leptin and normal leptin signaling before the tumor because they were normal weight before the tumor. But in the process of either the tumor itself in terms of damage or radiation or chemotherapy, that ability to transduce that leptin signal was lost. So these patients had anatomic leptin resistance. And that, of course, has since been borne out. So then the question is, all right, what do you do for them? I can't fix a brain. So we had this model in rats of lesioning the ventral medial hypothalamus, and these animals would become massively obese afterwards. So very similar to the human situation. And I knew that these animals had very, very high levels of insulin, extremely high. And so it had been postulated by several people that the connection between the hypothalamus and the pancreas was through the vagus nerve, the dorsal motor nucleus of the vagus nerve. So I said, well, okay, if these patients can't see their leptin, their brains must think they're starving. And therefore, their brains are basically telling them to increase the amount of insulin in order to drive extra energy into fat in order to continue to gain weight. Now, normally leptin would be the brake on that. That's a servo mechanism, a negative feedback system. But that servo mechanism is clearly broken because of the tumor. So what if we got insulin down? What if we gave a drug that would suppress the insulin rise from the pancreas? And I had a drug at my disposal. I'd never used it before, but I had it called octreotide. It was mainly used for adults with growth hormone secreting tumors. I said, let's give it to kids with this disorder to try to suppress their insulin because it worked for insulin too. And lo and behold, gave it to 8 patients in a pilot trial, and they all lost weight. These were kids who only gained weight. They all lost weight. But something even more remarkable happened. They started exercising spontaneously. One kid became a competitive swimmer. 2 kids started lifting weights at home. 1 kid became the manager of his high school basketball team. These were kids who sat on the couch and ate Doritos and slept.
Yep.
Their whole life. Anything they were interested in before went by the wayside after the tumor. And that was the thing the parents complained most about, was that they had basically, survived the tumor only to succumb to the therapy, that these were lumps on a log. The kids would say, I can't think. And so when we gave them the medicine, not only did they lose weight, but they started exercising. And that was bizarre. I mean, that didn't make sense, but it did actually. And the reason it made sense was because when you're starving, your sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight part of your nervous system, it's basically saying, I have to conserve energy because I'm starving. And so it tells your muscles, don't work. It tells your mitochondria, don't work, in an attempt to conserve. And so you sit on the couch. And because we were getting rid of the insulin in these kids, they now had energy to burn.
Yep.
And they were interested in doing so. So this was, and we ended up doing a double blind placebo controlled trial that showed exactly the same thing. And then we did two adult studies that showed exactly the same thing in a percentage of patients. So that about 18% of adults have this same pathology of the vagus nerve telling the pancreas to make too much insulin.
Yep. I've seen so many times when people adopt a low carb or a ketogenic diet, when they get their leptin and their insulin levels back down in the normal range, like you said, they spontaneously say, you know, I think I'm going to go for a walk, right? I think I'm going to join the gym, or I'm going to go for a bike ride. Whereas before, this same person would have been offended if you had invited them to go exercise. They would have been like, what the hell's wrong with you? Why would I want to exercise? Exactly. It spontaneously happens when the hormones correct.
So what this tells me and should tell everyone is that the biochemistry drives the behavior.
Yes.
We always ascribe obesity to gluttony and sloth, two behaviors. In fact, those two behaviors are manifestations of a biochemical process. And when you fix the biochemistry, you fix the behavior.
Yep, I totally agree.
And what that means inherently is that it's not the patient's fault.
Right. And anyone who either explicitly claims or accuses someone who's obese or overweight of being a glutton or a sloth or lazy or just no motivation, if you explicitly say that, or you implicitly, if you imply that, that is fat shaming, and that is not okay, because it is not the patient's fault.
And you've lost a patient, and exactly. They're never going to get better because, you know, you've basically called them a perpetrator.
Right. Yeah. It's their fault.
It's their fault. So, you know, I ended up writing the book Fat Chance to explain this to the public. Okay. I also wrote Fat Chance because I had to explain to people that, in fact, a calorie was not a calorie. That, in fact, what you consumed had everything to do with how it was metabolized. So the standard mantra, even today, unfortunately, I'm doing my best to try to fix it. The standard mantra from the doctors and the dietitians and the Surgeon General and the Institute of Medicine and the NIH and the White House and Congress is, you are what you eat.
Yep.
Now, I knew this was not true. I knew this back in 1975, that this was not true. And so I wrote Fat Chance to say, to, you know, set the record straight. You are what you do with what you eat, which is very different. You are what you metabolize. And metabolism is way more important than calories. Now, in the last 8 years, I have come to realize that one of the reasons that we all believe that, and when I say all, I mean everyone but you and me, believe that, is because that's been the food industry mantra. And they have been pushing that for the last 50 years. And we now have the documents that demonstrate the dark underbelly of the food industry and what they've been trying to put over on the American public. We actually have the food industry documents library here at UCSF to go along with the tobacco documents library. And we're actually using artificial intelligence to compare the wording and the phrasing in the documents to try to determine whether or not these are the same people trying to put the same thing over on the American public.
Yeah. And I love it that you brought that up. That's exactly where I wanted this conversation to go. So we actually have the smoking gun documents.
That's right.
That Big Food absolutely is aware of leptin. They're absolutely aware of dopamine and serotonin and insulin. They have physiologists and other researchers constantly learning how to tweak the junk crap food that they manufacture in chemical factories to tweak it so that it absolutely bungs up and mucks up your metabolic physiology, your hormones, so that you eat more. You're never full. They even say, you know, you need to go exercise, because they also know that if you do go exercise, it actually stimulates your hunger. So you'll eat more Doritos and drink more Pepsi. They put salt in the soft drinks. They put caffeine in the soft drinks. all so that you'll be more thirsty and that you'll drink more. They've got the high fructose corn syrup, which most of my listeners probably know was not even consumed by human beings before 1970. There, no human being had ever had high fructose corn syrup before the early 1970s. Right. But now it's in literally everything. I'm about to turn this platform over to you. We got 1,200 people watching right now. Probably 100,000 will watch this video before it's over. I want you to bring it, Dr. Luskety. I want you to tell us what big food, how have they been doing this to us? How have they been able to get away with it? And how are we as a grassroots movement going to be able to put a stop to this so that people can rediscover a proper human diet and rediscover that the food you eat and the junk you avoid actually makes all the difference for your health? What's the plan and what have you seen so far?
Indeed. So what I want to just finish with before we get into that is that I had to write this book behind me here, Metabolical, to update the information, because what I realized was that what I said in 2013 was wrong. I said, in Fat Chance, you are what you do with what you eat. But really, the real story is you are what they did with what you eat. And we're not going to be able to solve this problem until, number one, we own up to that and the food industry owns up to that. And so basically, this book behind me, Metabolical, is half science and half expose. If this were a Hollywood book, we'd call it a kiss and tell. But, you know, since it's about diabetes, it's really a piss and tell.
Yes, sir.
So what did they know and when did they know it? That's the question for the ages. All right. Number one, people think that the sugar industry adopted the tactics of the tobacco industry. That's absolutely not true. It's the other way around. The tobacco industry actually adopted the tactics of the sugar industry, because the Sugar Research Organization dates back to 1943. And the Tobacco Research Agency actually dates back to about 1951. MIT professor, and I hate saying it because, you know, that's my alma mater and I love MIT. But, you know, nonetheless, there was an MIT professor by the name of Robert Hockett, who was a member of the Sugar Research Association back in the 40s, who came to the Tobacco Research Association in 1952 or 53, basically saying, you know, you've got a problem here. You're being attacked because the Dahl paper, the Dahl and Bradford Hill paper from 1950, the first one to associate cigarette smoking with lung cancer, had just come out in The Lancet. And he went to the Tobacco Association and said, you're going to need the information and the tactics that we've developed at the Sugar Research Organization in order to fight this off. And so he actually went to work for the Tobacco Association. We have all these data. We have all the information. So we know as early as 1943, 1950, that the Sugar Association was aware that there was a problem. The next big one that, you know, sort of still makes my skin crawl comes in 1967. And in 1965, the Sugar Research Association approached two people at the Harvard School of Public Health. Fred Stair, who was the chairman and the founder of the Department of Nutrition there and grew it into the behemoth it is today, and Mark Hegstead, his assistant, who ended up becoming the head of the USDA during the 1970s. And they approached them and asked them to compose a treatise to be submitted as a review article to the New England Journal of Medicine. It ended up being two papers, ultimately, to the New England Journal of Medicine that exonerated sugar and fingered saturated fat as the cause of cardiovascular disease. And they were paid at the time $6,500 in 1967 dollars, which today would be about $50,000. for their work, you know, not chicken feed at the time. And basically, you know, they believed that sugar was fine. Okay. Now, they're allowed to believe that, but they're not allowed to take the entire litany of information that was known about the association of sugar with chronic disease and deep six it, and instead promote this saturated fat story. Now, the role of the Sugar Association in the research and the crafting and the editing and the publication of those two articles was never disclosed. And they say, well, you know, back then they didn't have disclosure requirements. Actually, they did, but, you know, nonetheless, they were not disclosed. So we here at UCSF, my colleagues, Kristen Carnes, Laura Schmidt, and Stan Glantz, have the paper trail of all the communications and correspondence that went on between the Sugar Association and Steyr and Hegstedt that went on during that period of time. So we know what the real story was. And what they were doing was basically economic and industry subterfuge. You know, this they were in, you know, 10 words or less. I mean, they were basically hiding the ball. And they knew they were hiding the ball. And this went on. And then, of course, we got the Dietary Guidelines for Americans in 1977. Now, I don't want to say that there was subterfuge there, but there may have been. George McGovern was in charge of the Senate Select Committee evaluating the dietary needs of Americans in 1977. His chief of staff was a gentleman by the name of Nick Mottern, M-O-T-T-E-R-N. And Nick Mottern was a Seventh-day Adventist. And Seventh-day Adventists, as you know, from the story of John Harvey Kellogg and Ellen White, okay, they believe that flesh meat, that's the, you know, their word for it, flesh meat, is the, basically the cause of everything, anything bad.
Including masturbation.
And especially masturbation.
Yep.
And that was John Harvey Kellogg's thing back in the late 1800s. And he set up his Battle Creek Sanitarium to cure two diseases, constipation and masturbation.
And this absolutely is all. And let me interrupt you there, Doc, for one second. Everybody listening to this, I know that what Dr. Lustig just said, that sounds so out there, so crazy. That's got to be a conspiracy theory, right? It is 100% documented. You can Google this. You can read this entire story.
Googling. I mean, go to the original sources, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of crap on Google, too.
True.
Okay? I'm talking about the real, you know, I'm talking about the primary literature.
Yes. But this is not conspiracy theory. This is 100% truth. And it is stranger than fiction, but it is nonfiction.
It is nonfiction. Okay, that's right. All right. So Nick Mottern, I don't know if McGovern was a vegan. I don't think so. But he sort of turned it over to Mottern. And Mottern had a, you know, I mean, he basically had a hard-on for, you know, basically getting rid of meat. And well, if you get rid of meat, saturated fat, what are you going to do? Well, you have to, you know, sort of add the sugar. So if you look at the 77 documents, the dietary guidelines, the original document said, eat less meat, eat less fat, eat less sugar. Okay. It's eat less salt, eat less sugar. That's what it said. That went to the industry, and the industry went ballistic. And they basically, you know, would not go along with this whatsoever because, you know, this was their gravy train. And so what they did was they worked out a deal with Mottern and the select committee. And so what the final document said, the 77 dietary guidelines for Americans, was eat more low-fat items. And that, of course, started the whole low-fat, no-fat craze. That's where we got Entenmann's fat-free cakes from. and, you know, fat-free cookies and, you know, et cetera. And at the same time, high fructose corn syrup had finally hit our shores in 1975. And that was one half the price of cane sugar. And it was also homegrown. And then when Hurricane Allen hit the Caribbean and basically wiped out the entire sugarcane crop, okay, we had to turn to a source of sugar that, you know, was more stable, as it were. And so that was the floodgate that led high fructose corn syrup into everything. And because it was cheaper, people got to use more of it. Okay. And they could actually lower the prices, even though they got to use more of it. And then they realized, hey, the more we add, the more people buy. And the reason, of course, is because it's addictive.
Yep.
In fact, anything that stimulates the reward center, the nucleus accumbens in the brain, is addictive. It can be a chemical or it can be a behavior. It can be a chemical like cocaine, heroin, nicotine, alcohol, sugar, or it can be a behavior, shopping, gambling, internet gaming, social media, pornography. Okay, all of those stimulate dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens. Okay, and so we like those things. Okay, the question is, when do you go from liking to needing? Now, pretty much anybody who's exposed to heroin for 5 days is an addict. Pretty much anyone who's exposed to nicotine for 2 weeks is an addict. Not everybody who's exposed to alcohol becomes an addict. That's true. About 20%. Well, it turns out about 20% of people exposed to sugar become addicts. So we have sugar addiction. So people who say, oh, I have a horrible sweet tooth. That's sugar addiction until proven otherwise. And if you look in the brain, that's, you know, you can see the imaging results. You can see the reduction in dopamine D2 receptors that correlate with addiction. And we have the physiologic data to show that, in fact, you know, addiction is what's going on. We here at UCSF have pioneered the use of what we call a naltrexone probe. It's an opiate antagonist that basically blocks opiatergic transmission in that nucleus accumbens. And so people who are sugar addicted, when you give them the naltrexone probe, they get really bad nausea and get super high cortisol levels, whereas the people who are not addicted don't. So, you know, we know that this exists. We know that we have this biochemical phenomenon that's, you know, physiologically driven. And we know that the food industry is doing it on purpose.
So let's talk about that. Let's go into that. How are they doing it on purpose? How do we know they're doing it on purpose? What are they doing on purpose? And then ultimately, what the hell can we do about this just as individuals?
Well, all you have to do is look at the food. So 56% of all the items in the American grocery store are ultra processed. 74% of the items in the American grocery store have been spiked with added sugar. And our sugar consumption is quadruple what our upper limit is. Okay, now we didn't end up there because we chose to be there. We ended up there because the food industry changed the food. You know how we know this? I'll tell you how we know this. All you have to do is go back to the 1951 volume of The Joy of Cooking. Okay? You take the same recipe from the 1951 volume and the same recipe from the 2019 volume, you know, because it's been around that long. And that recipe has 250 extra calories and almost double the sugar. So, you know, we've been, you know, shall we say, overloaded with sugar all these years. Now you could say, well, the food industry didn't do that. The publishing industry did that. Well, actually not. You know, it's because that's what our taste buds now think is normal. And the problem is it's not normal. So we know, again, we have the data that sugar is not a food. It is not a food. Now you say, how can that be? It's been around for thousands of years. You know, the Indians knew it. You know, they boiled sugar cane and reduced it down to this brown gunk that they put in earthen pots and, you know, put on boats and shipped around the world. It was called kanda, which is where we get the word candy from. That's all true. Okay. But no, they never had the amounts that we have today. Okay. And so little, you know, doesn't cause a problem in the same way, you know, coca leaves don't cause a problem, but when you purify it, cocaine does. All right. You know, opium, you know, is a medicinal in Afghanistan, but, you know, heroin is not, you know, that's a drug. So when you purify it, it takes on new properties. And the same is true for crystallized sugar. So we know that not only does sugar stimulate the reward center, that's old news now, but what's new news is that the molecule fructose, the sweet molecule in sugar, the molecule we seek, the molecule that makes sugar so divine, because glucose is not all that sweet. Glucose is like molasses, and like most people can take or leave molasses. Okay, but sugar, you know, and fructose is another story. Well, it turns out fructose is three mitochondrial toxins in one. Three. Fructose inhibits AMP kinase, which is the enzyme that basically is the fuel gauge of the cell that basically turns on mitochondrial biogenesis and increases mitochondrial efficiency. It inhibits the enzyme ACADL, acyl-CoA dehydrogenase long chain, which is necessary to start breaking up fats into two carbon fragments for oxidation. And finally, via uric acid, its effects on uric acid inhibits CPT1, carnitine palmitoyl transferase 1, which is the shuttle. Carnitine is the shuttle for getting fatty acids into the mitochondria for burning. So two direct effects, one indirect effect, all to reduce mitochondrial function. So sugar, when you burn it in a bomb calorimeter, releases 4 calories per gram. So you'd say, well, it's an energy source. And indeed it is. I don't argue that it is an energy source, except it's only an energy source in a bomb calorimeter. In human, if it's blocking mitochondrial function, that means it's not an energy source. That actually means it's an inhibitor of energy production. All right. Now, can you think of another source of energy that has calories that is not food, that there's no biochemical reaction in the body that requires it, that when consumed in excess, it causes cellular and human damage and death, and we love it anyway, and it's addictive?
Alcohol.
Alcohol. Thank you. Alcohol. So is alcohol a food?
No, absolutely
There's
not.
There's not one dietitian on the friggin' planet who will tell you that alcohol is a food. All right? But alcohol's calories. Is trans fats a food? Are they a food?
Exactly. No, absolutely not. They're poison.
Well, they are poison. They used to be a food.
Yep.
But they got reclassified because we now have the data to show that they are the devil incarnate. And the reason is because our mitochondria can't break the trans double bond. We don't have the enzyme to do it. We can break cis double bonds, but not trans double bonds. So trans fats just sit there and basically gum up the works and cause insulin resistance and all these chronic diseases. And we know that now they've come out of food. And in fact, the FDA has basically told the food industry that they are banned, and they have moved from food to food additive. So even though when you burn trans fats in a bomb calorimeter, they give up 9 calories per gram. Okay. That has absolutely nothing to do with whether they're a food.
Exactly.
Well, sugar is exactly the same. It is 4 calories per gram in a bomb calorimeter, but it inhibits ATP production at the level of the mitochondria. You want to call that a food?
So, yet so many dietitians and nutritionists do call it a food, and well, they get very offended at anybody like me who says, hey, you should avoid sugar. They're like, well, you're avoiding an entire food group. What's wrong with you? What kind of advice is that? But alcohol has calories. You can you can burn it in a bomb calorimeter. It's got roughly 7 calories per gram, but it's not a food. Trans fats, like you said, have 9 calories per gram, but they're not a food. They're a slow poison. But for some reason, the dietitians and nutritionists can't seem to wrap their head around just because something has calories does not mean that it's a food.
So this is the line in the sand. This is the red line. We are talking about it right now. Okay. It's not about calories. It never was. It's about what happens to specific foodstuffs in the body. It has to do with metabolic function, and it has to do with metabolic fate, and it has to do with metabolic health. Now, the problem is that that's not how the dietitians were trained. So a dietitian, look, there are good dietitians. Okay. And they worked for me in my clinic, and I needed them desperately in order to be able to teach patients what the real story was. So dietitians can either be part of the problem or part of the solution. Unfortunately, the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, the AND, formerly the American Dietetic Association, before they rebranded in 2012, they have chosen to be part of the problem. And the reason is because 90% of their budget is underwritten by Big Ag, and they don't want to bite the hand that feeds them. So I am calling you dietitians out.
Bring it.
Bring it. Okay. And you want to debate? I will debate you anytime, anywhere, and I will be nice about it, but you are going to friggin' lose because I got the science. All right. Yep. And you need to get off calories. Okay. They are your addiction. So when you start, embracing the science, then we can help. You can help solve this problem. And we need your help. God knows we need your help. But until then, you know, you're in my eyes, you're in my crosshairs.
Good. I love it. I know many dietitians on Twitter and a couple of cardiologists that I would love to watch you sink your canines into in a head-to-head debate, because no matter how much science you share with them, it all comes back to a calorie is a calorie. Move more, eat less, burn more than you eat. That's as simple as that. First law of thermodynamics, and then they drop their mic.
So in Fat Chance and in my Sugar the Bitter Truth video from 2009 now, you know, I say, look, the first law of thermodynamics is a law. Okay. I believe in the first law. Okay. So the first, if I didn't, you'd have to you'd have to run me out on a rail. I mean, you know, Copernicus and Galileo and, every other scientist would turn over in their grave. Okay. Yep. The first law of thermodynamics is a law. I agree with the first law. But there are two interpretations of the law, like any law, it's subject to interpretation. Now, what the first law says is the following: the total energy inside a closed system remains constant. I totally agree. First law is a law. But the question is, what's the interpretation of that law? The standard interpretation by the dietitians is the following. If you eat it, you better burn it, or you're going to store it. In other words, weight gain is a function of two behaviors: the calories in, the eating, and the calories out, the burning. So weight gain is secondary to two behaviors, gluttony and sloth. Therefore, if you're fat, it's your fault. That's the standard interpretation of the first law. But there's another interpretation of the first law, which actually takes leptin into account. And that interpretation is the following. If you're going to store it, that is an obligate weight gain set up by high insulin levels, and you expect to burn it, That is normal energy expenditure for normal quality of life, because energy expenditure and quality of life are synonymous. Things that make you burn energy make you feel good, like caffeine for 2 hours and amphetamine, you know, banned, you know, ephedrine, exercise. Things that reduce your energy expenditure make you feel lousy. Hypothyroidism, starvation. So energy expenditure equals quality of life. So if you're going to store it and you expect to burn it, then you're going to have to eat it. Now, the weight gain is primary, and the two behaviors, the gluttony and the sloth, are secondary. And the primary, the weight gain, is driven by a biochemical, insulin. And we know that high insulin levels interfere with mitochondrial function and tell the brain and interfere with leptin signaling at the level of the brain. So that's the servo mechanism that's broken due to insulin resistance.
Yep, absolutely. And my good friend Mitzi Champion just pointed out that the human body is not a closed system.
No, it's not.
And I actually, I reached out to my, I took calculus-based physics in undergrad, and I reached out to my old physics professor, and I told him about this nutrition argument, calories in, calories out, first law of thermodynamics. And he immediately said, well, that doesn't apply to the human body. It's as, about as open a system as you could possibly imagine. Your butt sitting on your chair, you're exchanging energy in the form of heat with your chair, the air in the room, when you breathe in and out, everything, it's a wide open system. We're basically just a tube.
So,
the human body is not a closed system. This is a ridiculous argument.
So there are about 50 really good reasons to kill the calorie.
Yes.
Nonetheless, the calorie continues, but people are getting the picture. People are getting, you know, figuring out what the real story is. Now, The Economist magazine, okay, in 2018, wrote a blistering critique called The Death of the Calorie.
Yes.
Okay, The Death of the Calorie. And that is exactly what we need to do. We need to drive the silver stake through the heart of the calorie, okay, so that it dies and never comes back. I want the calories taken off the nutrition facts label.
Yeah, it's useless. Because
they are useless. They are worse than useless. They are detrimental.
Yeah, let's make that the new hashtag, guys. Kill the calorie. That's our new hashtag
for this. Kill the calorie.
Kill the calorie.
That's right. You know, ultimately, it's not what's in the food that matters. It's what's been done to the food. In addition, another reason why calories are crap is because, in fact, of crap. Your microbiome. So you eat, so let's take almonds. That's a good example. Almonds, okay? You eat 160 calories in almonds, like a quarter of a cupful. How many of those calories do you actually absorb?
Not many.
130. You eat 160, you absorb 130. The assumption in calorie world is you ate 160, you absorbed 160, but you didn't. You absorbed 130. So where did the other 30 go?
Your gut bacteria metabolized and used them.
So the fiber in the almonds, soluble and insoluble, and you need both. So soluble fiber like pectins, like what holds jelly together, insoluble fiber like cellulose, like the stringy stuff in celery. The insoluble fiber forms a latticework, like a fishnet, on the inside of your duodenum. The soluble fiber, they're globular. They plug the holes in that fishnet, and they create a whitish gel as a secondary barrier on the inside of the duodenum and prevent absorption of glucose, fructose, sucrose, simple starches early on in the duodenum so they don't go straight to the liver and overwhelm the liver, thus causing insulin resistance. All right. So you're protecting your liver because the fiber keeps those calories from ever getting to the liver. So if they don't get to the liver, then they go further down the intestine. And what's in the jejunum, the next part of the intestine that's not in the duodenum? The bacteria. So the bacteria are not in the duodenum because the pH hasn't changed yet. The pH is still one from the stomach. You know, you have to inject the pancreatic juice via the ligament of through the sphincter of Oddi. Okay, and then that mixes with the chyme and it doesn't change the pH until about the ligament of Treitz, which is where the jejunum starts. And that's where the microbiome is because the pH is now 7.4. And so they can grow. Well, those bacteria have to eat something. And you have 10 trillion cells in your body, but you have 100 trillion bacteria in your intestine. Your bacteria outnumber you 10 to 1. Each of us is really just a big bag of bacteria with legs. Okay. Well, they got to eat something. The question is, what do they eat versus what do you eat? And the answer is, they eat what you eat. The question is, how much did you get versus how much did you get? Now, if you ate what you consumed with fiber, like almonds, the bacteria get more. And so they chew it up for their own purposes. So even though it passed your lips, even though it registered as a calorie consumed by the dietitians, actually, you didn't get it. Your bacteria did. Okay. And you know how in pregnancy, we always say, well, you're eating for two. Well, we're always eating for 100 trillion. Okay. And you know what? The first law doesn't take that into account.
Totally true.
So kill the friggin' calorie.
100%.
Right?
100%. Now,
and if you got rid of the calorie, then you'd be left with the science.
That's exactly
instead
right.
Instead of the math.
Okay. Would you think that the big food corporations are the ones that are propping up this calorie? I don't even want to call it a hypothesis, the calorie bullshit myth.
Oh, I know they are. And the reason I know they are is because I've testified them against them in court. So I've gotten to read their depositions. This is their juggernaut. This is their gravy train. This is what they hide behind because this is their method for evading culpability. Well, you know what? It ain't working so good anymore because, in fact, they've started to get sued and the players are starting to win. Have you noticed, have you gone into the store lately and have you noticed that Raisin Bran is now not heart healthy? Why is that?
Yep. It's coming. It's coming.
Who did that?
Now,
how did heart healthy come off the box of Raisin Bran?
Yeah. They had to settle a lawsuit.
Well, yep. Who was the expert witness for that?
I don't know. Who was it, doctor?
Who was that?
So, yeah, I've noticed there's been a lot of changes in the packages. And a lot of people may not know this about you, Dr. Lustig, but you also have a master's in law. You went to law school there for a little bit. And I'm not sure if you completed your JD or not.
No. I didn't want to. No. I didn't go to law school to get a JD.
Yeah.
Okay, I don't want to be a lawyer.
Yeah.
I went to law school to answer two questions. Okay. Back in 2007, when I realized that sugar was the bad guy in the story, okay, and I realized that this was tobacco all over again, right? I had to answer two questions. The first question is, how does a personal health issue become a public health crisis? And what are the legal doctrines that either support or refute that? In fact, that's essential for what's going on with COVID today. You know, how did something, you know, become a public health crisis? And how did the Supreme Court deal with vaccination prior to this disaster? In 1905, there's a Supreme Court case that was settled 7-2 called Jacobson v. Massachusetts. Swedish pastor refused to get vaccinated on religious grounds against smallpox. And the Supreme Court came down 7-2 and said, get vaccinated or get deported, because the public good was more important than the personal liberty. Well, what the hell happened? Where are we today?
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, this is a problem. So I went to law school to determine how does a personal health issue become a public health crisis? And the second question I went to law school to answer was, how did tobacco get away with it for 40 years? Because the food industry's using the same tactics.
Absolutely.
And so by understanding those two questions, I have become a more effective expert witness, a more effective policy wonk, and a more effective advocate.
And let me ask you, you have a master's in law, how ripe is the big food, are the big food corporations for a young, hungry assistant DA somewhere to file a lawsuit, you know, on behalf of the citizens of his or her state,
right,
that have been harmed by the Frankenfoods that big food puts on the grocery store shelves,
right,
or how ripe is the big food corporation for the plucking by a young, hungry trial attorney who would love to form a class action lawsuit and retain an expert witness, perhaps you. And then finally, would you be willing to testify if either one of those things happened?
So I already have, in terms of the class action suits. That's old news, and they continue, actually. The question you asked about the assistant DA, the young, hungry assistant DA, is a very good one.
Yes.
So this is called parens patriae, the state as the parent. And this is actually how we brought Big Tobacco to heel back in 1994. The Mississippi Attorney General sued Big Tobacco on behalf of the state, not on behalf of its citizens, but on its own, for its own purposes, because they were more than a nominal party, because they were losing their own money paying for lung cancer. Okay, so they weren't suing on behalf of their citizens. They were suing as a state, and they're allowed to do that. And so this concept called parens patriae, the state as the parent, is a very real one. And in fact, that was what I wrote my master's thesis on in law school, was could you use parens patriae to sue big ag or big sugar, really big sugar, okay, to recoup Medicaid costs for diabetes in any given state. And I suspect here in California, back of envelope calculation, that we could recoup about $2 billion a year to help, you know, cover those costs.
Yep, I totally agree. And any of you guys, if you have a relative who's a young district attorney, maybe let them watch this video. You never know what could come of it.
Well, I'm for it. And if there's anybody out there who, you know, has access to any AGs around the country, you know, let me know. We've talked with several, and what I can say is they're interested, but they sort of don't want to go first.
Yep. I totally understand. Nobody wants to be the first or the last to do anything. It's not cool. Yeah, I totally agree. So we've got almost 2,000 people watching right now, Doctor. Help all of us understand. So, you know, I'm just a regular guy with a wife and a dog and a job and a car payment. What do I need to do to start today or tomorrow? If I'm just eating the standard American crap, Kellogg's Kraft Post diet, what key things would you recommend that tomorrow morning, what should I stop doing and what should I start doing?
All right. Look, Dr. Barry, as you know, there are two philosophies of business. We give the public what it wants, which is reactive. And if you build it, they will come, which is proactive. Which of those two does the food industry use?
Tell us.
Both. They do both. All right. They built sugar as their, you know, mainstay. Okay. And then they say, we're just giving the public what it wants. So we're not going to fix this problem until the public doesn't want it. So it is up to every single member of our society to start voting with their fork. And you get to vote 21 times a week.
That's right. Vote with your fork, vote with your dollars.
The problem is that because 74% of the food in the grocery store has been spiked with added sugar, it's kind of hard to figure out what has it and what doesn't. And there's an easy way to figure it out. Just shop the periphery of the supermarket. If you've gone into the aisles, you've gone off the rails. That's the simple answer. All right. Sometimes you need to look at the package. you know, and you need to look at, you know, it now says added sugar. So you need to look, because if it's added sugar, that means it's been added by the food industry for its purposes, not for yours.
Yes.
Okay. And if you get rid of the added sugar in your diet, number one, your mitochondria are going to start working. Number two, your leptin is going to start working. Number three, you're going to start feeling better. Number four, you're going to start wanting to exercise. And number five, you're going to start losing weight just by getting rid of the added sugar in your diet. Now, people say to me, you are anti-dessert, you know, and that's un-American. And I have one simple thing to say as we're wrapping this up. I am for dessert. For dessert. I am not for dessert for breakfast, lunch, snacks, and dinner. If you want to have a dessert, you know, not only should you go ahead, but call me and I will join you, but make sure it is the best friggin' dessert on the planet. Okay. Make it yourself, make it with love, know what's in it. Okay. And if there's a little sugar in it, by all means, you know, and enjoy it. Okay. And do it once a week. Okay. What you don't want to do is think that, you know, the tub of ice cream is dessert, or that the, you know, that the breakfast cereal is dessert, or that the orange juice is dessert, or any of the other stuff that is absolutely laden with sugar. We are supposed to consume up to 25 grams of added sugar per day, which would be 6 teaspoons of added sugar per day. Our current consumption is 17 and a half, and it used to be as high as 22. All right. We're not going to solve this problem until we get down below the USDA guidelines. And we're not even, you know, remotely near there. And the problem is the food industry, they just keep plying you with more. Fix it.
Yep. Bacon is keep training, training all the dietitians, and they keep donating to all the sporting events, and they keep basically buying our attention. That's what they're doing. And then they're poisoning us with their sugar, their fructose, their trans fats, and everything else.
Right. If you need to understand the science, if it will help you move your needle, okay, then read this book. Okay. Now, I'll be honest with you. There's a lot of science in this book. Okay. Yeah, and I had to put the science in there. Otherwise, people would say, you know, he doesn't know what he's talking about. All right. I actually wrote this book for doctors, because doctors don't learn nutrition. They got to learn it somewhere. And the problem is that right now, Big Food is in charge of nutrition education in this country. So I had to write this in order to be able to actually, you know, give doctors, you know, a half a chance of actually figuring out what's going on so that they could actually help their patients. So if you pick up this book, just read the introduction. And if the introduction, go to the bookstore and read the introduction, or go on Amazon, okay, and read the introduction. It's, you know, practically the whole introduction is on Amazon for free. And if you like what it says, okay, then what you need to do is you need to take that book to your doctor, okay, invest however much money to bring that book to your doctor and say, you need to friggin' read this, okay,
yep.
Because you are part of the problem until you do.
Yeah, I think if you bought a copy of Metabolical for your doctor, and you bought a copy of Lies My Doctor Told Me for your doctor, and gave them to your doctor as a gift set for a birthday, for Christmas, for Doctor's Day, for Nurses Week, I think that'd be not only are you going to help that doctor be a better doctor for you, but you're going to help that doctor be a better doctor for all of their other patients. And so it's an excellent way to pay this forward and make the world a better place, make the world a healthier place by making everybody in your community healthier by teaching your doctor, because a good doctor is a student for life. Now, listen to me carefully.
A good doctor
is a student for life, and any good doctor is going to be interested. If you buy them a book and you spend $20 to buy them a book, they're going to be like, maybe I should look at this. I don't know. I've never had anybody buy me a book. That will wake most doctors up, if they're a good doctor, enough for them to go, what the hell? I'm going to read this.
So the same thing is true for dietitians. If a diet, If you don't know, if you're in seeing a dietitian, or if you're in association with a dietitian in any way, you have one question to ask them to figure out if they need this book. The question is, do you need sugar to live?
Yeah. It's an excellent key question.
That's the question. Do you need sugar to live?
Do you need to eat sugar to live? Yes.
Yeah. To be honest with you, you need a blood sugar to live, but you don't need to eat sugar to have a blood sugar.
That's the key question. Do I need to eat sugar to live? And if they answer that question wrong, you know, you can just walk right out and be polite if you want to, or you can be like me and Dr. Lustig if you want to be, and walk out of that appointment, because they're not going to be able to help you in any way if they believe you need to eat sugar to live.
That's right. That's the line in the sand. That's your red line, people.
I love it. Dr. Lustig, it's been a great pleasure. I think I have talked less during this discussion with you than I've ever talked in my life. And I'm perfectly happy for it to have been that way, because you are indeed a wealth of information. And let me just stroke your feathers a little bit. I consider you one of the giants upon whose shoulders I stand. And I hope you don't mind if I get up there, because your work is so brilliant. It's so deep. It's so wide. I love what you do. I think I watched your YouTube video back when it had 14 views, and I was immediately like, this is what I'm going to do. And it's so funny, because when I was in medical school, my least favorite subjects were endocrinology, nutrition, cell and molecular biology, and biochemistry. Those, I hated those. I loved anatomy. I wanted to do procedures. I wanted to be a surgeon. But now the joke's on me, because all I think about, all I talk about, all I read about, and all I put out videos about is endocrinology, nutrition, biochemistry, basic physiology. It's all in the first textbooks in our first 2 years of med school. Doctors, if you're listening, go back to the textbooks of your first 2 years. Yep. Forget all the prescription pad bullshit that you were taught. Go back and read your basic physiology, your basic nutrition, if you even had a class, and your basic biochemistry. Everything Dr. Lustig talks about is in the big fat textbooks that you begrudgingly had to read your first 2 years of medical school.
And that's why they're there.
That's right. But then it's trained out of us the next 6 years.
That's right.
Yeah, so I love it.
We're supposed to be doing continuing medical education, and the dietitian is supposed to be doing continuing dietary education, and the nurse is supposed to be doing continuing nursing education. Well, this is your continuing education, people.
That's it. I love it. So you guys go and get that book right there, mm-hmm. Metabolical. I got a link in the show notes on Twitter, on Facebook, and on YouTube. Get that book. I listen to it on Audible, because that way with ADHD, I could be cutting down trees with my chainsaw while I had Dr. Lustig in my ears. Dr. Lustig, thank you so very much for taking the time to do this. Thanks for doing all the work you do. I'd love to have you back on anytime. Next time, the next book you write, we'll do this again.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, my friend. Have a great day. Thanks so much.
You too.
All right. Thanks a lot, guys, for joining us. I'll see you next time.